Well, staying with research and researchers, here's a good example of why we need them. The research that shows postgrad students are sweating it out at our tertiary institutions for less than the minimum wage. A new paper out today analyses how the stipend portion of scholarships and awards granted to PhD and master's candidates haven't kept pace with the minimum wage, let alone the living wage. The research found that from 2000 to 2010, PhD scholarships grew on average from $14,000 to over $24,500, but over the next 9 years to 2019, only rose by $1,000. The researchers say the cost sharing of postgrad research is skewed in favour of universities who've kept their financial contribution low relative to inflation and living costs, and they say the overall effect may be to lock out certain groups from research careers. With us is Crystal O'Connor, a PhD student at Lincoln University. Kia ora, Crystal.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
And kia ora and welcome also to one of the authors of the paper who's with us first, Dr. Seriana Naepi. Welcome.
Kia ora, Catherine, thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. I wonder if you could outline at first for us where these PhD students sit in our research system. I've seen one description as the workhorses of research. Could you explain?
Yeah, so our PhD students are our top graduate students. They've already been at university for about 4 to 6 years, and they're the students that you can on they're at the forefront of our research. So they tend to be the students that we kind of go, here's the problem, go work on it by yourself, and they come back with solutions. So PhD students are the people who are doing the heavy labor. They're doing the on the ground work, while people like myself who are in tenured positions or in permanent posts tend to kind of meet with them once every 2 weeks to a month and go, okay, cool, where are you at? So they're really the glue that holds our research sector together.
The key word there is work. This isn't just education per se. They're at a stage of their education where they are working academics.
I think this is the point of tension, right? Are they a student or are they employees? And I think that this is, we've seen this play out in Australia, where graduate students have taken their universities to court, and some of them have won around, if you are limiting the hours that we're allowed to work in order to receive a scholarship, what does this mean about our relationship with the university? So if we're paying students and we're saying this is your stipend and these are the outcomes that we expect, is that a work contract or is that a student contract? And I think that's where the tension kind of lies, is are our PhD students experiencing this as a job when the university sees it as you're a student and we're giving you a degree?
Well, somewhere in the middle is, okay, you're a student, you are doing useful work for us, but also you just made the important point, and we're limiting how much work you can do outside and therefore earn outside. How does that work?
So usually what that means is that students will be given their scholarship. So the PhD will say, they'll go, this is your scholarship. But in their sort of letter of offer of scholarship is a limitation of how many hours they can work per week. And one of the things that we know is that if they're working within the university and they're limited to 10 hours a week, they're still falling under the costs of living in some of our major cities. So worked into the system is that PhD students are being asked to take on debt for basic living needs, which in turn kind of contributes to the inequity of our research sector, as you need to be independently wealthy to be on a scholarship and live in our main centres.
So that's immediately going to affect who can do this straight off the bat.
It really is. And I think that when we talk about a sector as a sector, we're saying, oh, we need more equity groups in here. But the doorway to our research sector, the PhD, you need a PhD to participate in our research sector. The doorway is firmly shut on people who aren't willing to go into debt or who are who aren't independently wealthy. So those are kind of your options. Lean on your family for money or go into debt weekly to pay your rent or to buy food.
We've just heard from Gemma McGeegan, an outstanding and world-class PhD now, has her PhD, working on science at the moment that is absolutely at the heart of the global pandemic that we're all grappling with. These are the people we want in New Zealand, and we want them across all kinds of disciplines and from all walks of life, Seriana. And are you seeing increasingly that's getting harder and harder, just as we sort of do all the talk about wanting to diversify, it's getting harder and harder?
It's definitely getting harder and harder. How do you convince a Māori or Pacific student to, or community member to enter a PhD when you know that when they graduate, there's going to be a pay gap, when you have to sit across the table from them and say, hey, you can only work 10 hours a week. This is the amount we're offering you. You're probably going to have to go into debt to do this, or you're going to have to lie to the university and jeopardize your scholarship by working extra hours. And it's, you know, these are the people who are at the front of our COVID-19 response. You talk to the permanent academic researchers, but behind them is a whole team of graduate students making it possible, doing the modeling, looking at the little bugs. I'm a social scientist doing what they do. We've got our climate change response, our child poverty responses, the housing crisis, depression. All of these things are being looked at by graduate students who are leading the way. And I think we need to ensure that graduate school is an attractive option so that we have multiple and creative solutions, not just to the issues we're facing today, like COVID-19, but the next pandemic or the next global crisis. And if we continue to limit the people who can access graduate school, we're going to limit our solutions.
What have you seen happening, Sidiana, in your time, to the support, the financial support for these students? Because it looked like it just fell off a cliff at 2019.
It really does. You know, I went overseas to do my PhD, better scholarship opportunities. So I went and completed over at the University of British Columbia because I could get a better scholarship. I could get better living conditions. Vancouver is just as expensive as Auckland. I think Auckland might be more expensive. But I went overseas because I knew that I would be able to afford doing a PhD there. And my PhD was on Pacific women's experiences working in universities. What does that mean for me to complete a PhD where there's not, with no Pacific people supervising me? These are the sorts of questions we need to ask, where if we're forcing our equity groups to go overseas to complete their research, what's shaping their research and what does that mean for Aotearoa? Do I bring my research back or do I stay in Canada and shape those things? And this is a sector-wide problem at every single stage. And what we're trying to do when we map out these projects is show every single stage of the research journey is working to exclude diverse students and diverse researchers, and that's a problem.
How much of an impact did the removal of the postgrad student allowance make? It was never restored by the Labor government when it came in, was it?
No, it wasn't. There's a paper, we'll be having a paper come out soon, that shows that the drop-off right away. You see the drop-off in enrolment. So one of the responses to a sort of official petition to the government to reinstitute the allowance was the government said, oh, well, we haven't had a problem postgraduate student enrollments increasing. But when you look at how many students go from a master's to PhD, that dropped off. So one of the things we do know is that the transition from one graduate degree to the next level up dropped when we stopped student allowances. And, you know, Universities New Zealand, our students, we're all making that call to reinstate that allowance, because that's going to make the difference between having to go into debt weekly. And I want to make that really clear. It's a weekly debt to buy food. It's not a student loan. It's a weekly debt to live. And why are we okay with this when these are meant to be the people that will drive the solutions to our problems?
Sidiana, would that also resolve this issue of it being a scrap between, may I use that word, advocates for students and universities themselves over the funding splits? If the allowance came back, would it be clear cut what it is?
I think that very rarely do you find the universities, the students and the researchers on the same page when it comes to how we're going to solve the problem. But this seems to be Universities New Zealand, our research paper, the student unions are all calling for a reinstatement of the student allowance. It's one of the solutions that we pose. It's one of the solutions that Universities New Zealand has called for. It's one of the solutions the student unions have called for. So when you have three parts of the sector on the same page, it's probably a good indication to government that this will be a thing that will make three parties happy.
Naomi, thank you very much, Dr. Sidiana Naipi. And listening in, and thanks for that, is Crystal O'Connor, PhD candidate at Lincoln, and has helped organise a petition calling for the stipend to be raised at least to the same as the minimum wage. Kia ora, and thanks for your time, Crystal.
Thank you for having me.
Can we hear your story, please? Why you embarked on your PhD, and interestingly, when you embarked on it?
Yeah, so I started my PhD this year in March. I actually moved down to Otatahi, Christchurch, to do it. This was after a 3-year gap of finishing my master's in 2017. And the reason for that gap is because when I was doing my master's, I didn't get a stipend. I did get other scholarships that helped me, but I really relied on working. I was milking cows 3 days a week, morning and night, and it wasn't sustainable for me. It put me in a highly stressful situation because on top of my research, my 40-hour research work, I had to work to live, and I wasn't able to cope. I actually scratched scabs into my legs while I was asleep, and I was at the point where I made my partner and close friends promise me that they wouldn't let me do a PhD because they couldn't face living like that. But going out into the workforce and working and traveling for 3 years, I got good savings behind me, and I was able to actually think about what I wanted and actually be able to take on my passion because I had the financial backing. And I knew that I couldn't do it if I had to work. So having the savings behind me actually allowed me to consider doing a PhD and getting into the research that I wanted to do. So going into my savings every week isn't sustainable either, but at least this way I am taking care of my mental health. And that's one of the main reasons that Caitlin and I decided to do the write a letter to the universities calling for them to increase the PhD stipend to make it accessible for everyone, because it isn't right now. You have to be financially secure, and that's not fair.
You were working and overworking to support yourself, but at many universities, do they actually limit how much external work someone can do, even if they're up for it?
Yeah, exactly. So because I didn't have a stipend, I wasn't limited to the amount of hours that I could work, and it did get into a dangerous zone. But it is a vicious cycle, really. Like, your well-being is affected if you don't have the financial support. You're trying to produce high-quality research as well.
The other thing that's happening, Crystal, is that we're watching the cost of living, particularly the cost of accommodation, just skyrocket. And is this seriously affecting, I mean, people's well-being, I'm hearing from you, and their ability to live week to week, but is it also just seriously going to affect who is going to pursue this level of study, or perhaps whether they're going to do it here?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people that we talk to that are doing PhDs right now, they have support from partners and whānau, but if you're the one that has to support whānau, then you're not in a position to do a PhD. It can't even be an option for you.
When you read through the research that Celiana and others have done, did it just register with you through and through? Are you seeing the same story wherever you look?
Yes, absolutely. It's very clear, the issues, but the solutions are so easy, which is one of the most frustrating things that I find as well. Like, part of doing a PhD, you have to do a proposal through Lincoln University. And one of the first things you do is a budget. You have to show that you've thought out the cost of your projects to make sure that the research is actually feasible. But what I'm seeing is that they're not budgeting our living costs into the structure of how they give out stipends, which isn't fair, and it doesn't really make sense to me.
How is the petition going? Are you sensing some sort of a groundswell about this?
I think it's going largely good. We have found that we've had to push it a bit, but there is lots of support. And we do find that in general, everyone is getting behind it, because there's so many people that know someone who has done a PhD, wanted to do a PhD. And we've also had some high profile support as well, which has been great. We're just over 3,000 signatures at the moment. We are trying to create lots of awareness and build a big momentum. So if you are listening and able to help sign, every single signature counts. I mean, this is everyone's living that we're talking about. We're not asking for much. It's minimum wage to living costs, you know.
I think your particular specialty is how native plants can add to the nutrition of insects. Again, we're looking at an incredible problem, really, aren't we, when we're looking at many of our pollinators and just many of the factors of our food chain and our food supply. So again, you're right in the heart of stuff that matters. Mind you, it's just about all stuff that matters, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm actually looking at edible insects as a sustainable source of protein. We already know that insects provide a good amount of protein, minerals and vitamins. I'm looking at how Aotearoa plants can enhance the nutritional profile and give them added value.
So right on the cusp of a big food innovation and a big change undoubtedly coming at us as we look at more sustainable nutrition and diets, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. And I love my PhD. It's giving me hope for the future, you know, different alternatives to look after our environment. But yeah, you're right.
Go well, Crystal. Thank you, Crystal O'Connor. And you can learn more about that paper of Seriana Naipi and others by the hyperlink on our webpage.